by Dr. Timothy
Gish.
Gish, thank you. His presentation title is a comparison over herbicide runoff and volatilization plots over multiple years.
Okay, well, for a lot of the discussions today and also next door, they've been talking about fairly volatile insecticides and fumigants. Herbicides are considered to be a lot less volatile, and so we thought we'd actually do a little presentation here. What happens is that we're actually concerned at looking at something a little bit larger scale. So here we're trying to look at the major off-site transport mechanisms for a number of agricultural compounds, obviously for this lecture, herbicides. And we're also trying to, that way we're looking at field observations, which are closer to what the farmer actually sees. And at the same time, we're trying to look at a number of different loss pathways. So when you look at the literature, you find out that there's not a lot of comparison directly between herbicide volatilization and surface runoff losses. If you go to the EPA website and start looking at herbicide volatility for both these, atrazine and metolachlor, you can see that they're considered fairly non-volatile because of the low vapor pressure. As a consequence, when you look at the site, they'll say, well, the major loss pathway is surface runoff processes. Now, it's kind of critical that we actually evaluate these. Now, atrazine and metolachlor, as most of you may know, are probably two of the most widely used herbicides in agriculture in the U.S. and overseas, where we have well over, I guess essentially close to 70 million pounds of active ingredient which are applied annually. The approach here is we have, in order to understand the climatic interaction with the pesticide formulations and also the soil properties, we've been trying to conduct this experiment for a number of years, 13 years now, and I'm because the time it takes to process everything and the first couple of years we had some different instrumentation out there, I'm going to show you, as the abstract talks about, 8 years of data where we simultaneously measured surface runoff and herbicide volatility. Now, to actually calculate herbicide volatility, as Andrew's talked this morning, Dr. Van der Zog, we're using a micromet approach here. So we have an eddy covariance system out there, and this eddy covariance is a full-blown energy-based system, so we can close energy balance system. And what we're doing is we're actually calculating the turbulent fluxes, the eddy dispersivity for water vapor and temperature and momentum. And when you do that, there's this similarity theory that appears to be valid, where the dispersivities are very similar. So it gives you a degree of turbulence that's taking place. And that's here's a distant shot of the eddy covariance system here, and here's a 3D sonic anobber. You'll see that later in another picture. And then what happens is if you have that data, and then you also have a profile, concentration profile of the herbicides, then you can actually generate a flux. And what happens here, you can see the actual 2-meter tower. We have 30, 60, 1.2, and 2 meters. And here's where the pumps are, and then we have this manifold. Now, this manifold is kind of cool because actually John Pruger and his group put that together. There's sometimes you have uncertainty as to what the airflows are, and so we developed this so you can actually dial in your negative pressure. So you have the same airflows at all heights and all times. Very, very sweet. So we do that for the first 5 days after application. But for surface runoff, we actually turn on the system about a month before we apply, and we let it go until November. And so the runoff data I'm going to be showing you actually is for 5 months, where the pesticide volatility is only for the first 5 days after application. So there's a big difference in time here, but I think you're going to be kind of impressed with what you see as far as the actual losses that come off. I don't know whether I'm kind of going through this really quick. If I'm talking fast, it's because I have a lot of slides I want to try to get through. But what happens is we've got some other things going on out there, and if I get time, I'll share it with you. One of them is increasing the duration of the volatilization experiment from 5 to 10 days, which makes me well-loved in my office because we monitor day and night, so it goes throughout the night. And then we have some other things we're doing for footprint analysis and cloud analysis for number 6, but I don't think we're going to get to that today. Anyway, so here's the eddy covariance system again. Here's John Pruger, in case you guys don't know him. Both John Pruger and Bill Kustis are probably two of the top micrometeorologists in ARS, as you saw in the first slide they were on. Now, sometimes you have the wind that comes and hits the tower first, but hits the 3D sonic anemometer. And so we have other backup systems. which are just a few meters away, where we also have duplicates of wind speed, temperature, and humidity, and things like that to actually still close the system. Now, in addition to that, there's a lot of instrumentation I'm not sharing with you, because on this particular research site, it has about 90 scientists internationally at various times of the year that do things out there. And so I'm just trying to keep this focused. But what happens is, on the research site, we actually have, this is 100 meters, the star circle from where the Eddy Covariance Tower is. The runoff flumes are here and here, that you'll see the runoff data that comes from that's just been combined. And I just give you an idea of scale. But what you'll see is little black marks, and those black marks represent an area where at 4:30 in the morning, we go out and we take two samples in these locations. Now, they're randomly picked. 50% of them are in 50 meters, 40% are between 50 and 100 meters, and then 10% are outside. And the computer just picks those. We go out, GPS them, mark off roughly a little over a square meter, and we go out there at 4:30 in the morning, we take two samples. And about, 3 centimeters deep, and it has a cross-sectional area of about 30 square centimeters. One of those is used for pesticide analysis, so we have an idea of what the pesticide concentration is in the shallow surface before the sun comes up, just before the sun comes up. And the other one is used just for water content, because we're kind of interested to know what the water content is in equilibrium to see if there's any impact there. Now, we have a lot of other things out there, but that's important data to have us actually capturing water content. Now, so here's some runoff data. So concentration is a function of time. It really doesn't say anything new. Yeah, we all know that concentrations are higher when the precipitation events are shortly after application, and they decrease exponentially with time. What's kind of interesting is that you can have a lot of rain events that don't generate runoff, which happens to everybody. And of course, that doesn't show up here. It's just runoff stuff. But one of the things we've noticed is that if the runoff event doesn't occur within the first 3 weeks after application, the concentrations are low enough to where even if you have a large rain event, there's a very small flux that actually comes off. And so if you actually get the fluxes, and here you see it for the years, this time of application, number of runoff events in the first 5 months after application, and this is one of the things we want to focus on. But first I want to show you that the application times change quite a bit. We do the same thing that farmers try to get a crop in as soon as you can. And you can see back in one time we got in April. One time we didn't. It was July 14th. And it rained all the time. And we just had a hard time getting our crop in. And when we finally get the crop in, not only is the soil moist because it's been raining so much, but we also have a lot of energy coming to the system. So things are a little different there. So when you look at the volatilization data, I've had to separate that out. And you'll see why in a few seconds. In general, these runoff losses are very similar to what you find in literature. A lot of times you don't see very much. Sometimes when you have a runoff event that occurs close to the application, you can see a significant impact on runoff. And so you see close to 3% for atrazine in 2001, almost 1% in 2003, and fairly similar amounts for metolachlor, which really isn't surprising considering their chemical properties. But in general, you see what you find in literature. However, On the same fields, the same time, here we're looking at the metolachlor that's lost, again expressed as the percent of applied. And you can see that for excluding 2003, for 4 of the years, you're talking 6 to 7%. That's the minimum that we lost in those first 5 days alone. And you can see that there's 3 other days here where we lost more than 15%. And you can actually see the changes. You can also notice that after about 72 hours, for the most time, it's kind of asymptotic, and that's important. My last slide, if I actually get to it, because I want to talk about processes if I can. So you can see that there's quite a bit here. We're talking now up to 23-24%. Atrazine, as you notice, has a slightly lower vapor pressure and is less soluble. Its volatilization losses, again expressed as amount applied, is actually significantly less. We're talking mainly about 4%. But unlike metolachlor, we actually see in 2002 it actually decreased when the temperatures were cooler. Remember, that's when we applied in April. But when the soils were wet and warm, we saw some more come off here. So what happened to 2003? Now, 2003, remember, was kind of unusual because it was moist. It had been raining. We tried to get the crop in April, and it rained every week a couple of times until July. And the subsurface hydrology, which is well understood on the site, was very active. And Soils weren't saturated, but they were close, you know, very wet. And what we have here, see, this is where everything would have fallen. Here's 25%, and here this goes up to 70. And actually, through the energy covariance system, we actually, and you see it's not asymptotic, but after 5 days, we lost in the vapor phase 63% of what was applied. Now, remember, we took those little soil cans and said, well, how well do they agree with each other? You know, are we talking the same thing? Well, if you look at that, those soil cans suggest that 65% of the metolachlor is missing. But 63% of it we find in the vapor phase, which means for a non-volatile compound, we've lost 95% of the non-volatile compound after 5 days of volatilization. This is kind of disturbing to me. And then for atrazine, it's only about 11%, still quite a bit less than metolachlor, but there's about 29% of it that was lost, again, from the soil residue, from the cans. And so you're talking roughly, I have it here, about 41% of the atrazine was actually lost through the vapor phase. So that's kind of scary, you know, when you consider that you go to the website, EPA thinks these are non-volatile. Of course, I've had a lot of discussions with them the last year or two, so hopefully they're changing their perspective on that. But when you actually compare them side by side, this is what you see. Here's the blue for atrazine, and here's here's the runoff losses. There are little lines in there, you just can't see them because of the scale of observation. Same thing with atrazine. And what happens is if you then take, well, if you assume the years as replicates and you average over the herbicides for atrazine and metolachlor and do just a simple statistical analysis, you have a highly significant difference between runoff and volatilization. And it comes out that atrazine is about 25 times, that the herbicides are 25 times greater losses in the vapor phase than runoff. So some of the initial thoughts are that, you know, we've got a problem here, you know, that certain volatilization is the major process, not runoff. And that makes sense because regardless of what happens, the compound's going to vaporize. It's going to go to a vapor phase. But runoff, you have to have a runoff event. And you can have a rain event, and the rain event increases the water content, which could change the vapor pressure, and the thing can go off a little more readily, which I'll show in a few seconds. A few more things. I've got 5 minutes. I'm going to try to go through these pretty quickly, so hopefully you'll bear with me. But there's some process stuff that are not necessarily abstract, but I thought would be interesting to a few of you. One of them is, because we understand the hydrology, we actually have more than one flux tower, and so where the soil textures are essentially the same, except they're different in water content between two. And the organic matter content is also a little different because it's moister. It also has higher yields generally in dry years or average years, so it has higher organic matter content. And so here's a graph of herbicide volatilization and temperature as a function of time. And the solid line on the top here is temperature, and then here are the fluxes. And you can see how the fluxes actually are linked up with the peak temperature. But when it cools off, you lose that. And also, when it's dry, you lose that. So the soil has to be moist before the temperature has an impact. So just saying you have an increase in temperature doesn't mean squat, unless you also know what the soil water content is. And of course, these peaks here that you see down here, and every once in a while you see one here, are due to increases in relative humidity and also a dew deposition that takes place, which Taylor and Glatfelter and others have seen. Because we have these different locations, I'll go through this real quick as well. Here's a wet site, dry site. And this year, the wet site and dry site, it was a drought year, and the water contents were very similar, and the fluxes are the same. But you can see that even with a higher organic matter content, it has a higher water content, almost double. And what happens is pesticide fluxes are double. And that essentially tells you that water content trumps organic matter content. Which is kind of an interesting little side note. Last thing is if you take the water content and say, well, those individual little cores that I took in the morning and average them over the first 72 hours, and then do the same thing for the pesticide fluxes, what do you see in relationship as a function of time? So this is like an annual thing. And you can see a nice little exponential curve that takes place here. Now, there's not much going on down here, so you can say, well, maybe it's a straight line, and then it's got something else, and then anybody's guess is as good as mine. I personally think that what's taking place is that you have an increase in water content, and probably as atmospheric demand increases, you probably have a curve that goes up this way. And if it's a little cooler temperatures or things like that, it probably goes like this. So you're going to have a range. So anyway, that's a little bit of process data. I told you it went from 5 days to 10 days. The data I've shared so far is 5 days, but you can see what happened in 2010. This is again flux concentrations of metolachlor and atrazine. You can see how it exponentially decreases with time, a rain event, then it goes back up again. And actually you see the fluxes are actually about the same at day 4, 5, and 6 as they were day 1 and 2 for atrazine, which is kind of interesting. And then metolachlor, you see an increase, but relative to T1 and to earlier time periods, you see it's not as much. So with that, we know that soil moisture is probably the most critical soil property that's affecting the fluxes on the herbicides, and we need to actually quantify that more. And I can talk to people about that footprint analysis. Even all the data we've talked about and published is 5 days, there's actually a lot more compound coming off. And that soil moisture trumps organic matter content. And I got to that pretty quick. Hope I didn't lose you, but if you have any questions, I'm willing.